We're so glad you're here to listen to this week's sermon from Park Street Church. Park Street is a historic congregation located in the heart of Boston. But more than that, we're a community of people from all different backgrounds who believe and are united by the good news that Jesus is Lord. If you're asking questions about God, your faith, or the meaning and purpose of life, we would love to connect with you. Visit us at parkstreet.org to learn about our community. We hope this sermon encourages you today.
The reality of human sin is what forms the backdrop of our lives. And I can illustrate this very well by the fact that 3 million pages from the Department of Justice were just released on Friday about a story of notorious sin that we can't seem to escape, which is about greed and lust and power and the exploitation of the vulnerable. And the reality of sin just floods our world. And it's not just sin out there, it's in here too. I don't think we should ever look at stories like that and think of ourselves as in some way untouched by those same realities that are within us. Sin isn't just the backdrop of human life, of our life today, and it's always been this way, but it's the backdrop of the biblical narrative as well. We are going to be looking at the passion narrative in Matthew's gospel during the season of Lent. And if there is any narrative in the Bible that shows us the reality and the dark reality of sin, it's the passion narrative. We see denial and betrayal and false accusation and ridicule and mocking, all kinds of things that epitomize what human evil and rebellion is. And when I say sin, what I really mean is that we have missed the mark. We're not what we were created to be. Every one of us has missed the target. I also mean that a genuine kind of rebellion from the Creator, the one who's made us and for whom we were created to know and love and enjoy and obey. We've chosen not to follow his way, but to actually go with our own opinion, to choose our own path. I also mean habits and realities that are in the tradition of the church, these deadly sins of things like gluttony and lust and anger and sloth and more, that those things touch our lives. So this is the backdrop. And it's also the backdrop of the narrative that we've been studying since last September in the book of Exodus. There is the reality of human sin is there. We see it, of course, in Pharaoh and his oppressive regime in which he is exploiting the vulnerable and squeezing every last drop of labor and productivity out of the people of Israel. But we also see it in Israel as well, in those people. Remember when their backs are against the wall or against the sea, literally, in Exodus 14, and they start to complain to Moses for bringing them out of Egypt? And then just a couple of chapters later in chapter 16, when they want something to eat and they long for the meat pots that they had back in Egypt, why didn't we just go back to Egypt? And then in chapter 17 or 18, when they want some water to drink and they do the same grumbling. And so, and then we get their most significant and most egregious act of sin and rebellion in the text that we're looking at together today in Exodus chapter 32, the text of the making of the golden calf. And so I do invite you to open up to Exodus 32. The background of sin, though, demonstrates the brilliance and the beauty of God's grace, which is where I hope to take us by the end of this time together. Exodus 32. Up to this point, despite what I just said about Israel's sin, they've actually been quite well behaved since they got to Sinai in chapter 19. In fact, three times, once in chapter 19, and then twice in chapter 24 at the covenant ratification moment, they say to God, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. And after they said those things in chapter 24, then as we turn to chapter 25 and this direct address from the Lord to Moses that's taking place at the summit of Mount Sinai in the fiery cloud, for seven chapters, God speaks to Moses about the provision that he is making for his holy presence to dwell among a sinful people. And that's primarily through the tabernacle and through the priests, as we've seen over the last couple of weeks. And God is giving Moses this vision of what is to take place. And this is a renewing of what happened in Eden, where in the Garden of Eden, where human beings that God had created in his image were dwelling with God and he was walking among them in his presence. But everything shifts dramatically so when we get to verse 1 of chapter 32. All of the goodness that's been promised up to that point is suddenly threatened. One scholar refers to Exodus 32 as Genesis 3 all over again. That's the fall, the original fall of humanity into sin. Well, what you have here in Exodus 32 is the fall of Israel into sin. And so much gets threatened by this. Things went very, very wrong. And our goal today as we look at this text is to understand what went wrong and a little bit about the response to it. And we'll come back to this to finish next week. But I don't just want you to understand, as any time we're studying the Old Testament, the goal isn't just to understand Exodus 32 better. The goal, hopefully, is to understand through the Old Testament Jesus better and our own lives better as well. And particularly, the goal for us today is to heed the New Testament admonition that the Apostle Paul gives in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, which is a text where he cites what's going on here in Exodus 32 as one of the negative examples. And he calls God's people, he says this, "Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry." Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. My hope is that we can all grow in fleeing from idolatry as a result of looking at the negative example of Israel's idolatry in Exodus 32. And as we hear that admonition, let's not think of ourselves more highly than we ought. Paul says in this text, "If anyone thinks that he stands, let him take heed lest he fall." We are to approach this call out of sin, out of false worship, into the truth of God with humility, recognizing that we don't have the strength in and of ourselves to overcome evil. But thanks be to God, God always provides a way out. God gives us the pathway, and he provides the strength and the power through his Spirit that we might actually live into and heed this exhortation. "Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry." This is exactly what Israel did not do in Exodus 32. So let's take a look at their idolatry together first. Their rebellion, it occurs in the first six verses of chapter 32. What happened? Verse 1, "Up," they say to Aaron, "make us gods who shall go before us." How foolish of them, isn't it, to think that gods can be made? It implies a foolish kind of thinking on their part. Man-made gods, as we read elsewhere in Scripture, and Psalm 115 is a great place to see this, which are made by human hands, these have eyes, but they cannot see. They have ears, but they cannot hear. Feet, but they cannot walk, and so on. They are lifeless and powerless. But this is what Israel demands of Aaron in verse 1. Now, as the leader of the people of God, especially in Moses' and Joshua's absence, instead of restraining the people's wickedness, one of the most mind-blowing parts of this six-verse text is that Aaron actually joins their rebellion and facilitates it, and in many ways, he leads it. He comes up with the idea for them to take off their gold earrings and give them to him, likely the bounty that they had left Egypt with as they plundered the Egyptians on their way out, as we read about in chapter 12. And then in verse 4, we read that Aaron received the gold from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made a golden calf. Nobody seems to have told Aaron to do this. I think the idea of making a golden calf was his idea. It was his choice, and it was intentional. This animal was a ubiquitous symbol of divinity in the ancient Near East. And we should note at this point that the word calf doesn't really mean some cute little baby cow that seems kind of harmless. That's not what we should envision here. The word can mean bull, and can mean a bull all the way up to 3 years of age. So this bull, this young bull, is a symbol of power and might and latent fertility. And that's why it's commonly a symbol of divinity in the ancient Near Eastern cultures around Israel. So Aaron knows what he's doing when he makes this golden bull. It might be better to say bull, just to change that image in our minds. And then what do they say after he makes this image at the end of verse 4? "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." If that sounds familiar, it should, because it's a direct contradiction and rebuttal to God's affirmation of his singular sovereignty in their rescue. As God began to speak to them at Mount Sinai in chapter 20, verse 2, God says this, I am the Lord, Yahweh, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. And so they're directly refuting that claim here with this golden bull that Aaron has made. You might notice some ambiguity in this, and as we read this text, we can't be 100% sure whether this bull for the Israelites is meant to be a symbol of Yahweh himself or a replacement for him. I think on balance, the text points us toward a replacement. Either way, though, it is a violation of God's instruction to them, a direct violation of God's words given from the mountain. It is Aaron then makes an altar before the golden bull in verse 5, and Aaron made, he built an altar before it, and then Aaron made a proclamation and said, tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord. Now, to associate the name of the Lord, that particular name that God revealed to Moses at the burning bush in Exodus chapter 3, Yahweh, with this metal image that he had used a graving tool to make from gold, that is a violation of the third commandment, not to use the name of the Lord in vain. So now as we look at this story of their rebellion, they have blatantly broken the first three of the 10 words or commandments that God spoke in Exodus chapter 20. No gods before me, no carved image, don't use my name in vain. Still, in their rebellious fervor, we go on in verse 6, they rise up early the next day and they offer burnt or ascension offerings and peace or fellowship offerings. And then we read, and the people sat down to eat and rose up to play. What an irony that the offering, the fellowship or peace offering, which was given to demonstrate that all is well between God and the worshiper, such that they can now, and remember, that's the one offering that the worshiper eats from the sacrificial animal. They are enjoying a meal of covenant fellowship with the Lord himself, a meal that we continue to this day in the new covenant meal of the Lord's Supper that we will share in just a few minutes, that signifies that all is well in this covenant between God and his people. That very meal now becomes the means by which the rupture between God and his people is indicated. And for this word at the end of verse 6, play, the NIV has translated it indulged in revelry. The word has sexual connotations elsewhere in the Old Testament, and likely, though we can't be sure, implies some kind of sexual revelry here as well. This is a hedonistic party. And when we read in verse 25 that Moses saw that the people had broken loose, that means that moral restraint had been thrown to the wind, and the people unraveled badly and quickly. This is their idolatry and rebellion, a direct disobedience to the words that they had promised that they would obey. And before we consider the response, I want us to dive deeper into a few dimensions of their idolatry, particularly as we think about our own lives seeking to flee from idolatry, learning from their negative example. First, notice where their idolatry stems from. It's interesting. We need to notice it if we're to learn from this negative example. See how verse 1 begins. When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, there was a delay. Look how verse 1 ends. As they're making their appeal to Aaron to make gods, they say, as for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. Now, we should be a little bit empathetic. Let's not forget that Moses has been up in that fiery cloud at the top of the mountain for a long time. Not just a day, not just 3 days, not just a week, but at this point, over a month. And they might be thinking, you know what? Moses is probably not coming back. Maybe he died. We don't know where he is. But it's time to make some kind of solution. What's this arising out of? It's arising out of their impatience. a restlessness with their present circumstances that leads them to do something awful. How often does impatience lead us to make foolish choices? The great 19th century preacher here in Boston, Phillips Brooks, there's a story reported about him that he had a frown on his face, and someone came and asked him, Reverend Brooks, what's wrong? And his answer was, I'm in a hurry and God is not. And I think we can identify with that. When we fail to wait upon the Lord, or in this case, for God's people to wait upon the Lord's mediator, we will likely do stupid, foolish, idolatrous, and rebellious things. Let me give you the two best examples of this in the biblical word in the Old Testament. The first is, of course, of Abraham. He'd been given a promise, remember? A promise that through him, God would make a great nation, and he still didn't have a child. And so he and Sarah waited year after year after year, no child. What does Abraham do? He gets impatient. He chooses to make a solution from his own devisings. God, I got this one. I'll figure it out on my own. And he takes Sarah's servant Hagar, and with Hagar makes a child. But that creates much heartache, exploitation of Hagar. Remember, she gets sent out and is dishonoring to the Lord. It's a mess. The second great example from the Old Testament is actually that of King Saul. He was told by Samuel to wait for 7 days. And he waited for 7 days, but then Samuel didn't come. And so what does Saul do? He's like, look, I'm getting impatient. We need to keep moving. I'll just make the sacrifices. Though he was not authorized to do so as the king, only Samuel could. And so he offers a burnt offering to the Lord. And then Samuel shows up and Samuel says to Saul, what have you done? Impatience leads us to step out from under the covering of God, from the worship of God, and into things of our own devising. And it gets us into trouble and leads us down pathways that are disobedient and idolatrous. And the consequences are severe, as we'll see in this text as well. For Saul, they were severe. Samuel says to him, in that moment, the kingdom will be torn from you. So the question is, where are we impatient this morning? Where are we tempted to take matters of our lives into our own hands? Where are we frustrated? Where are we frowning because we're in a hurry, but God is not, and we're not willing to sit back. We're about to take that step to get rid of pain, to find a relationship that seems to be so elusive, to deal with our financial troubles in some underhanded way. Second, in their impatience, the people of Israel actually desire and demand a more tangible and more present and more controllable God. What do they say when that golden calf is made in verse 4, as we've seen already? These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. Here they are, right here in front of you. You can see it. You can shout to it. You can go pat it if you want to. Right here. They want a God that they can see, that they can control, who will always be before them, right there in their line of sight. So they act in haste, and the invisible God becomes a tangible image. And the consequences are awful. One commentator concludes, the ironic effect is that the people forfeit the very divine presence they had hoped to bind more closely to themselves. We can either receive God and worship him as he has revealed himself to be, a God of mystery, a God of transcendent glory, a God of holiness, a God who is at the end of the end incomprehensible, though he has revealed himself adequately for us to know him, or we can fashion a different God, a God in our own image that we can better understand and control. But the great folly of that kind of idolatry, of clamoring for a God of our own making, perhaps it's a God that we can fully grasp with our minds and our reason, is that in doing so, we lose connection with the one true God who is the only source of life and power in the world. This is powerfully symbolized in our text in verse 19 when Moses, coming down from the mountain, sees the people in their revelry, and he takes those two tablets on which God had written the words of the covenant, and he throws them down, and they're shattered. And when they're shattered, the covenant is represented on those tablets. It is shattered as well. Their demand to have a God in their presence, in their midst, on their own terms, a rushed making, not anything like what the tabernacle instructions were of this painstakingly detailed and time-intensive process. Their demand to have the instant and the controllable put the only thing they needed in jeopardy. Third, not only is there impatience, not only is there a desire for a God that we can control, but then thirdly, these gods of our own making always tend to bless the indulgence of our fleshly desires rather than to redirect and frame those desires, pointing them towards the only one who can fulfill our desire. As we saw in verse 6, they rose up to play. And in verse 25, they have broken loose. Their idolatrous worship enables them to indulge their more basic appetites, whether with food or alcohol or coddled anger or revenge or sex. The gods of our own making will not challenge us to become holy, and as such, they will never bring about our freedom. Rather, by indulging our fleshly appetites, we can become enslaved to them. This is not to say that we cannot seek to fulfill our natural human desires. No, God created those desires, and they are good. But he intended for them to be satisfied only within the confines of the structures that he created for them, in which they are to be enjoyed, and in the moderation with which they are to be enjoyed. When they become everything, as they were here, obviously, for Israel in this moment, they enslave us. To make them our aim, to throw off restraints, to break loose, as our text says, is to lose the one for whom we were made, the one who alone can satisfy our desire, and the one to whom all of our desires point. Who of us does not at times feel impatient with God? Who of us does not at times long for God to be more understandable, more tangible, more in my grasp? Who of us does not feel temptations and the wooing of fleshly desires? But remember, greater is he who is in you than he who is in the world. Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. With our time remaining, let's look at the response to this idolatry that we see in our text. As we saw in the opening of the book of Exodus, particularly at the dialogue in the burning bush between Moses and the Lord, they have a deep, honest, wrestling kind of relationship. And we see that deep honesty happening here in our text. God speaks first to Moses. You see this in verse 7. Go down, he says. But notice what he says next. For your people, whom you brought up out of the land of Egypt. Notice those pronouns. Your people, whom you brought up out of the land of Egypt. God is distancing himself from those people. We'll see Moses come back to that in a moment. In verse 8, God recounts what they have done. And then in verse 9, he speaks to Moses again. And he calls Israel a stiff-necked people. I've seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people. That's a farming metaphor that describes an animal that refuses to go where its owner directs it to go. And then he tells Moses in verse 10, now therefore let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I may consume them, in order that I may make a great nation of you. Tempting, perhaps, right, for Moses? I mean, if we follow the book of Exodus, we know that this has not been an easy people for Moses to lead. They've been grumbling and complaining. They've turned their back on Moses. They've asked him, why did you bring us out? I mean, here's an offer to Moses, but Moses doesn't take it up. In fact, actually, there's an allusion here to what's going on in the book of Genesis. Notice in verse 7, God says the people have corrupted themselves. That word there for corrupted is used in Genesis chapter 6, verse 12, which is the scene right before the flood when people had become wicked and corrupt. Same word. And what does God do in that story? He remakes humanity from one righteous man. It seems as if the same idea is here in his mind, to remake Israel now through one righteous man. There is a resonance back to that text. But Moses, in solidarity with the people and in humility, and not in any way being driven by a concern for himself, this was a leader who was not in any way driven by ego. He rejects this plan that God lays before him. And he demonstrates in verses 11, 12, and 13 the power of intercession. It's beautiful. And let's look at it together. In verse 11, Moses says, "O Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people, whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand?" Did you catch the pronouns? Moses is directly contradicting and challenging God's words in verse 7 boldly. Why is your wrath burning hot against your people, whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? God, these are your people and you rescued them. You're the one who came. I didn't do any of this. It was your doing. You called me at the burning bush. Remember, I didn't want to go, but you told me to go. This was your job. These are the people that you've redeemed. Don't turn your back on them now. Your redemption isn't yet complete, God. But use your mighty hand and your arm, your great power, to rescue. That's what he appeals to, his redemptive work in verse 11. What does he appeal to in verse 12? He appeals to God's reputation and glory among the nations. What was the point of God intervening to rescue his people all along, as we've seen in the book of Exodus? The series is called God Made Known. God wanted to make his glory known, not just to Israel and not just to Pharaoh and the Egyptians, but to all the nations. We saw this in Exodus 9. You remember chapter 5 when Pharaoh says, "Who is Yahweh that I should obey his command?" Well, he will come to find out. And so Moses is appealing to God's desire to be made known to the nations. And what does he say in verse 12? "Why should the Egyptians say, 'With evil intent did he bring them out, to kill them in the mountains and to consume them from the face of the earth'? Turn from your burning anger and relent from this disaster against your people." He's appealing to God's desire for his glory to be made known. And so he intercedes on that basis in verse 13 with the Lord. Sorry, in verse 12 with the Lord. And then he goes one step further in verse 13. "Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, / Jacob, your servants to whom you swore by your own self and said to them, 'I will multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven. And all this land that I have promised, I will give to your offspring, and they shall inherit it forever.'" God, remember your promise. Remember the covenant that you made with our forefathers. That's what motivated you to hear the cry of your people in Exodus chapter 2 and to come rescue us out of Egypt. It was so that you could be faithful to the promise that you made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Don't turn your back on your promises now, O Lord. Don't destroy this people. Rather, fulfill the promise that you have made. Moses is pleading the promises of God with God in intercessory prayer. It's a powerful intercession, and it works. Verse 14, we don't get God's response. But what do we see? With quite staccato, "And the Lord relented from the disaster that he had spoken of bringing on his people." T.D. Alexander, a commentator, says this: "God's change of mind is not presented here as a divine failing, but rather reflects his autonomous freedom to exercise compassion that is part of his immutable nature," end quote. It also reflects his willingness to take on board in his sovereign outworking of his will, human intercession. He takes intercession seriously and includes it in the outworking of his purposes. I'm reminded of Blaise Pascal's saying, 17th century mathematician, converted to Christ in his late 20s. "God has instituted prayer in order to give his creatures the dignity of causality." It's a great thought. God has incorporated here Moses' passionate intercession on the basis of God's own commitments and character in leading him to take this different path. Of course, the observation of an affirmation of this interplay between the divine sovereign will and human intercession does not by any means answer all of our questions about how prayer works, does it? But it should. If it does anything else to us this morning, it should convict us once again of the importance and power of intercessory prayer. And though God relents from his stated plan for complete destruction. The rest of chapter 32 tells us that there is still punishment for some, even as there is forgiveness granted. And this unique interplay between divine punishment and divine forgiveness is really the theme of chapters 32, 33, and 34. And we'll see it again as we come to the resolution next week. Moses comes down from the mountain in verses 15 through 19. And then in verse 20, he begins to deal with three entities in three different parts. One is first, he deals with the golden bull. Notice in verse 20 that he burns it with fire, grounds it to powder, and scatters it on the water. And then he makes the people drink the water that they would taste the bitterness of their idolatry in a very visceral way. He destroys the carved image. Then in verses 21 through 24, we get his dealing with Aaron. And in this dealing, I mean, this is perhaps one of the more awful moments, tragic, comic moments in all of Scripture. He basically comes to his brother. Aaron's his older brother. Aaron's been at his right hand throughout the whole ordeal of bringing Israel out of bondage in Egypt. And he's like, Aaron, what were you thinking? What did you do? And Aaron has the world's worst blame shifting ever. It's worse than Adam's in Genesis 3 when he says, the woman you gave me. This is even worse. Look what he says in verse 24. So they gave it, that is the gold, to me, and I threw it into the fire, and out came this calf. Like, no mention of a graving tool, no mention of his idea that a calf would be good. No, it's incredible. Aaron's folly. And we'll come back to him in the conclusion. But then the third group that gets dealt with, so you get the bull is dealt with, then Aaron is dealt with, and then we get the people in verses 25 through 29. And these are challenging verses for us. But let me point out a couple of things here. One is that Moses in verse 26 says, who is on the Lord's side? Come to me. Which is to say that even in this revelry, this idolatry, this debauchery, there are some within Israel who are standing back, who have not bought in to the fullness of this idolatrous rebellion. We learn that they are at least the Levites who come to Moses. And then God uses Moses to instruct the Levites to be his divine agents in bringing punishment, most likely on the most egregious, rebellious ones who were leading the charge. We know that 3,000 were killed in that day with the sword. Brothers and companions and sons, it says. That doesn't necessarily mean the Levites were killing their own nuclear family members, but any within Israel could have fallen under those terms to them. They were all related in that sense. It's tragic and it's awful. Such sobering events remind us of the expectation of allegiance and loyalty for those who have entered into covenant with the holy Lord of glory. You shall have no other gods before me. And to sit loose on this in our idolatry is to court disaster. And in the final verses of this section, from verse 30 of chapter 32 to verse 6 of chapter 33, Moses learns of just how disastrous this might be. There is mercy. There is forgiveness. Look at verse 3 of chapter 33. Go up, God says, to a land flowing with milk and honey. That's forgiveness and mercy, that they would still, some of them would still be able to go. But I will not go up among you, lest I consume you on the way, for you are a stiff-necked people. Idolatry leads to the loss of God's presence, the only thing that we ultimately need and desire. Or does it? It's not quite that determinate yet. And look at verse 5 to kind of leave us toward next week. God instructs them to take off your ornaments. And then he says, that I may know what to do with you. That's the ESV. The NIV translates this, I will decide what to do with you, suggesting that there is still some back and forth to come. And we'll see that, in fact, there is with Moses in this chapter and two ahead. Nonetheless, let it be a heart-wrenching, awful reminder of the seriousness of sin and of idolatry. In conclusion, Brevard Childs, an Old Testament scholar, says that one of the key effects of chapters 32 through 34 in Exodus is that they place, quote, the institutions of Israel's worship within the theological framework of sin and forgiveness, end quote. Another way of saying this is that the idolatry of Israel reveals again and again in the deepest way possible the need for divine grace to be active and permeate this world if there is to be any possibility of life in the presence of God, of restoring the fellowship that was there in the beginning of creation between God and man. And we see that grace, even in its earliest forms here in chapter 32, being poured out upon the people. God did not destroy them in total. We see that grace in Aaron, Moses' elder brother, not being struck dead despite his leading role in the idolatry. I think about Aaron. I think of the fact that Aaron is to become the high priest who will enter in to the Holy of Holies on that one day a year, the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, when he goes in with the sacrificial blood to make atonement for the sins of Israel and for the sins of the priests. And every year when he goes in, is he not singing that great hymn that we love to sing, Come Thou Fount, which says, "Oh, to grace, how great a debtor daily I'm constrained to be." And it's not just Aaron, it's David. It's Paul, it's Peter. These great leaders of the covenant people of God can never wipe out or forget the reality of their rebellion and their sin against him, so that they would be emblems and reminders of the fact that fellowship with God is rooted in the grace of God and the mercy of God and the forgiveness of God that no one deserves. And we see the grace of God in the provision in this text of a mediator who stands in solidarity with his people and who intercedes for them. Moses plays an instrumental role in securing the grace of God for a sinful people. But of course, Moses just points to the greater mediator, the greater Moses, Jesus, the greater Aaron, the great high priest, who always lives to make intercession for us, for you and for me. God has made a way by his divine grace to bring us in to fellowship with him. Therefore, my beloved, the beloved of God, flee from idolatry. Let's pray. God, we thank you for your abundant grace, and we pray that you would exercise that grace in our lives even today. If there are areas where we are tempted by impatience or control or fleshly lusts to reject you and to turn to the idols of this world that can never give life. God, give us grace to let go, to trust, to believe, and to lean into your grace and mercy and forgiveness through your Son, Jesus, whom we love and in whose name we pray. Amen.